One Shining Moment might be the anthem for March Madness, but for our special guest today on Musings on Golf, his One Shining Moment also ranks as one of our game's most dramatic shots. Kelly Elbin, welcoming you back to our show, and along with Jenna Self, our executive producer, you will hear shortly from Robert Gomez, who won three times on the PGA Tour and whose second victory was truly one for the ages. The Nestle Invitational, March 25th, 1990. Gomez, one shot behind Greg Norman and Larry Mize, playing with Larry Mize, waiting for Larry Mize, who had sprayed his tee shot out to the right. Initially, Gomez was going to hit a cut 6-iron, switches to a 7-iron, momentum and adrenaline pumping up, draws it in, ball hits the green, one hop, and into the hole for an eagle two. What a crazy, unbelievable golf shot. I got to tell you what, look, Tiger Woods chip in at 16 to win the, to essentially, you know, eventually win the 2005 Masters. Unbelievable drama. Larry Mize chipping into the playoff to beat Greg Norman at the 87 Masters on number 11. Tom Watson chipping in on 17 at Pebble Beach to eventually beat Jack and win the U.S. Open. But I can't think of another full shot swing that ended a golf tournament ever than this one. Yeah, I guess you could maybe say Gene Sarazen, although I don't know about you. I was not around in the 1935 Masters when Sarazen made double eagle at 15, the great par five there. But that wasn't even the final shot of the tournament. This essentially was the last shot. And as you're going to hear from Robert, he's had a lot of ebbs and flows in his career. When he won that tournament, that was his rookie year, and that was his second win as a full member of the PGA Tour as a rookie. And you'll hear a lot about the times he spent with Mr. Palmer. You'll hear about his career. He was a terrific amateur player, a collegiate player at the University of Arizona after a stellar high school career in Las Vegas. You're going to find out kind of what Robert is up to today. So it'll be a lot of fun hearing that. Great win for Matt Fitzpatrick at the RBC tournament in Hilton Head over the weekend. I'll tell you what, anytime you've got Scottie Scheffler breathing down your throat, you can see kind of what happened there with Fitzpatrick. He couldn't hit good shots down the stretch. Scheffler did, and then caught him. And then inexplicably, after just a laser second shot by Fitzpatrick in the first hole of the playoff, it almost looked like Scottie Scheffler fanned on his second shot. And then knocked it on, but he didn't have a chance to putt. Great birdie putt for Matt Fitzpatrick. Second time that he's won at Hilton Head. And he is establishing himself, obviously, with having won the U.S. Open at the Country Club more and more. Matt Fitzpatrick is really establishing himself as a major threat out on the PGA Tour. And for any time they tee it up for any big event for Scheffler, look, back-to-back finishes, second at the Masters, second at RBC, he's playing well. He's just got to get out to a better start. I mean, these slow starts, only, you know, you can only catch up so many times. He came 11 shots he gained on Rory over the weekend at the Masters, but that wasn't enough. Can't put yourself that far behind. And if Scotty can just kind of get it in his mind to get off to a better start, get focused early on, he'll have a lot more success. Hey, congratulations to Stuart Sink. Stuart Sink's having a heck of a season on the PGA Tour Champions, won the Senior PGA Championship over the weekend at the Concession Club in Bradenton, Florida. Terrific golf course designed by Jack Nicklaus and Tony Jacklin, stemming from when Jack conceded a putt to Jacklin at the Ryder Cup. And it's a terrific golf course. I have no idea how Stuart Sink finished 19 under par. He won by 6 shots. Stuart Sink this year has won $1,460,000 on the PGA Tour Champions. The second leading money winner so far is Zach Johnson, $730,000 behind. I mean, Sink is on a roll. This qualifies him for the PGA Championship next month at Aronimink Golf Club outside of Philadelphia. Terrific test of golf. Gary Player won the PGA there in 1962. Jeff Kitty, the PGA head professional at Aronimink, is going to be our guest the week of the PGA Championship. Sad news out of Hawaii. Not surprised that the PGA Tour, for the first time in many, many years, will not have Hawaii on its schedule. And you could maybe look for a PGA Tour Champions event in Hawaii at one of the two courses at Kapalua or at the course that hosted the Sony Open. But not surprising. They're looking to start the PGA Tour season a little bit later in January. They're looking to start it in prime time somehow. And Hawaii just kind of fell off the radar. And it's a shame. But, you know, a couple of things I want to talk about before we turn this over to Robert. I had a chance to play with my good friend Dennis Walters. Dennis, member of the World Golf Hall of Fame, just always an unbelievable inspiration to me. Dennis, having lost the use of his lower body in a golf cart accident and has gone on to perform tens of thousands of trick shot golf shows. And Dennis and I, along with Kevin Hammer, the new president of the United States Golf Association, had a chance to play at the park, the terrific daily fee course here in West Palm Beach, Florida last week. And Kevin Hammer lives up to his last name, by the way, the son of Lori Hammer, PGA professional, who was the head professional for many years at Delray Dunes here in South Florida. Kevin Hammer can flat out play and can flat out hammer the ball off the tee. He is played collegiately at the University of Florida on some really good teams. But more than just being a really good player, Kevin Hammer is the kind of leader that you want at the USGA. He's begun his two-year term as president. They're doing a lot of really exciting things. They've got this national developmental program for juniors, which is a big emphasis of his and of the USGA. The US Open, we talked a little bit about Shinnecock Hills and the challenges that come with hosting a U.S. Open at Shinnecock. Not exactly the biggest piece of property, unlike what you had a couple of years ago, say at Pinehurst. But they're going to put on a great show there. And it just had a lovely time playing golf with those two and a lot of fun. As a matter of fact, I'll be playing golf again with Dennis later this week here at East Point Country Club, where I'm a member. And let me close with that. I was so proud yesterday of my club. I've been a member here at East Point Country Club in Palm Beach Gardens for 5 years. And as we record this on Tuesday, the 21st of April, it was just yesterday that East Point hosted a local qualifier for the U.S. Open. And our par 72, a George Fazio designed golf course that we made some renovations to a couple of years ago, did it ever hold up well to 80-some players from South Florida, a lot of really talented golfers, for five spots to advance to the final qualifying stage. And quite honestly, I thought you'd see some real low scores out there. We did have some rain, and that could maybe raise the score of the top players a stroke or two. But 72 under par was the very best that anybody could do. Our golf course held up extremely well. The course looked great. It played hard, and just so pleased of what we were able to do as a club. It's a shining moment for East Point Country Club, our 36-hole facility, and really proud of my buddy Jim Rattigan, our two-time defending club champion. Jimmy went out in 34 playing the back nine and was really at the top of the leaderboard at that time, struggled coming in, finished with 76, no matter, played as hard as he possibly could. Very proud of Jim, and again, very, very pleased that the USGA saw fit to have a local qualifying here at East Point, and excited for the future of our club. Finally, before we get to the interview with Robert Gomez, I felt it important to weigh in on the situation with LIV Golf, and not so much what I have to say about it, but I wanted to read to you, if you haven't already read the Q&A, one of the questions asked of the great Tom Friedman, award-winning columnist for the New York Times, who, as well as anybody, has the pulse of what's going on in the Middle East. Not so much in terms of golf. Yes, I mean, Tom grew up as a golfer. He actually caddied in the U.S. Open in his native Minnesota, and has a great passion for the game. But he knows the Middle East inside and out, and all that is going on over there. And in an interview with Golf Digest last week, they asked him a number of questions about the LIV situation. I want to read to you the last question. I think it's really pertinent. Question posed to Tom Friedman was, to what extent has the Iran war and the current Middle East climate played a role in the Saudis potentially pulling back on LIV? And his response was, it exacerbated a problem that was already there. Even before the war, the Saudis were canceling or slowing down a lot of domestic building projects. They were trying to do too much at once, recognized that, and so they began cutting back buildings and projects that were seen as too expensive or too unnecessary. Live fell into that bucket, and the Iran war just exacerbated that trend. While the price of oil per barrel has gone up, and that is good for an oil-producing state, the Saudi oil industry suffered some real costly damage from Iranian attacks, and in the future, they are going to have to spend billions more on their defense. I think this is when Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman realized that this golf tour was not bringing a single new tourist to Saudi Arabia. It was only a money drain and an easy one to sunset. And frankly, folks, I think that's your answer. The decision had been made to really, as it turned out, line the pockets of a handful of golfers, some of whom were on the latter stages of their career, and they're just not getting anything in return. And sinking $5 billion into Liv, and now you've already seen Brooks Koepka, Patrick Reed leave, and Bryson DeChambeau asking for $500 million to return. It's almost like he's telling that he doesn't want to come back. So I do think the end of Liv is near. And having the voice of Tom is one that, you know, lends a lot of understanding as to what's going on with LIV Golf in the Middle East. Okay, now let's hear from Robert Gomez. Really good interview. You're going to enjoy this. And also remember, before we head off and hear from our friends at William & Harry and the Friars Golf Club, please listen, subscribe to Musings on Golf through Apple Podcasts, through Spotify, wherever you enjoy your podcast. Support us as best you can. Robert Gomez, right after these words from our good friends. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com. Golf is more than your scorecard, the brand of clubs you play, or the clothes you wear. Golf is a journey where every round is a memory, filled with friends old and new. The Friars Golf Club is where those lifelong friendships are made, on the first tee, in the 19th hole, and far beyond. Exclusive trips, unforgettable rounds, and the very best people. Indeed, great courses are simply better with great company. So join the Friars today. To learn more, email us at info@thefriars.com and put the word musings in the subject line to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. So we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience at the Friars Golf Club. One electrifying shot that stunned a shark may define who the golfer is, but the story of our special guest today is so much more than a single moment in time. It's a story of the ebbs and flows of our great game and how he has overcome off-course challenges to both win again and to celebrate the essence of our game. He's the pride of Las Vegas, Nevada, and he has much to talk about as we welcome Robert Gomez to Musings on Golf. Robert, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's really great to catch up with you. We have, as I mentioned, a lot to talk about. Your career has been a most interesting one, and obviously so many people, those who follow golf remember the moment in 1990 when your 7-iron spun into the hole on the 18th hole for 176 out to win the Nestle Invitational. We're going to get into some specifics on that. But that now is known, obviously, as the Arnold Palmer Invitational presented by MasterCard. And Mr. Palmer was there, I'm sure, after that shot was made. You lived in Orlando for quite a number of years, 23 years or so. Can you talk a little bit about what Mr. Palmer may have said to you after that victory, and just maybe a time or two when you had a chance to play golf or spend some time with Arnold.
Yeah, you know, obviously that shot was amazing, and winning his event was career defining for me, and one of the highlights, if not the highlight of my career. But getting to know Mr. Palmer was even a better part of it. Obviously, after the shot, and you know, he congratulated me and said, "Wonderful shot," you know. And I can't remember everything. It was, you know, you win a tournament like that, and your mind goes crazy. So you just don't. It's hard to put everything into perspective and to remember, you know, remember specifics. But after moving to Orlando, I started playing at Bay Hill and became a member there a couple years after I moved. And so I was around him quite a bit and got to play some of the shootouts with him, and just being able to watch him. What was amazing and how he treated people. I did get to play with him, reverse back to 1990. We played a practice round at the PGA that year. He invited me to play with him and Rocco and Bob Ford. And that was a great story. Played this practice round and we're having a good day. It was actually Arnold and myself against Rocco and Bob. And we get to the seventh, I think it was the 17th tee, and backs up to one of the houses. And there's a fence right there, and you know, it's a practice round, fun day. One of the people at the house, they're having a little party watching the practice rounds, and somebody yells to Arnold, you want a beer? And he goes, sure. So he grabbed the beer, grabbed this bottle, started chugging it, and gets almost to the end. He goes, here, kid, and hands me the bottle to take the last swig out of it. It was such a great moment as a rookie and the champion of his event, and to get to know him and play that practice round with him was fantastic. I don't remember how the match turned out, but I'm guessing that we probably didn't win, but I don't remember.
Strong Pittsburgh connection. I mean, you had Bob Ford, who was at Oakmont at the time, Rocco, and of course, Mr. Palmer with his lineage back to La Trobe, right?
Yeah. And so that's how my relationship started with Mr. Palmer, even after the tournament win, because, you know, he wasn't really playing much at that point in time. You know, he pretty much stopped playing the tour. And so I didn't see him much out on the tour, and I was playing a lot of golf. I played 35 events, I think, my rookie year. So I didn't really get around him. So playing that practice round with him was just fantastic. And then fast forward to being in Orlando and, you know, obviously every year I went back for Bay Hill, we had a past champions dinner. I get to be around him and just be around him that week. But fast forward to moving to Orlando in 2002 and then joining the club, I think it was 2004 or 2005, maybe I actually officially joined Bay Hill, and getting to watch him and play with him around the shootouts and just being around him in the locker room and things and getting to know him a little bit. I didn't get to know him as well as a lot of the friends he had there already, but getting to know him, what I did was just fantastic. And just watching how he treated people. To me, I wouldn't go up to somebody while they're eating food or doing something like that, but you'd see him having breakfast and somebody come up, he'd be sitting there eating and somebody come up to him and just to say hi. And he would be so cordial and just, sign autographs, take pictures. I don't know if he ever wore a meal, you know. Yeah. Then he'd be on the range getting ready for a shootout. He had a spot on the range hitting balls and getting ready to play. And people come over, ask for pictures. And he was just so gracious to take them and sit there and talk to him for a minute. And it was no big deal. And it really taught me how to be around people. Was I great at it when I was first started? No, not at all. But after moving to Orlando and getting to know him and watching that, I got better for sure. It changed the way I tried to handle people. And if I had a bad day on the golf course, I tried to give it a minute and then not take it to the fans and you know, try to be there and do, you know, sign autographs and you know, talk to anybody that wanted to talk.
Yeah, he was the rare, larger-than-life figure, Robert, who never was too big for anybody.
No, I mean, he could see it. And you know what, growing up in Las Vegas, I carried standard bearers for the regular tour and the Champions Tour and the LPGA. So I got to see these people, you know, when I was young. I mean, and got to see my idols, you know, the Arnold Palmers, the Jack Nicklauses, and guys like that playing in Las Vegas for the tour events. And I remember seeing Arnold after he got done playing in a Champions event, just sitting in his cart and sign autographs. I mean, I have autographs still of his sure. from back then. I didn't realize how big that was for me back then, you know, getting to see that and looking back on it now, knowing, you know, fast forward as a professional now and watching him do it all the way up until he passed, just unbelievable, and realize how big he was and how great he was for taking the time.
No question. Hey, Robert, I watched the video of your shot the other day. You're playing with Larry Mize, and Mize sprayed his drive out to the right. You had 176 to the hole, and you originally had a 6-iron in your hand, right?
I did. I my normal shot's a fade, and right. and I played a fade as long as I can remember. And so I had 176, and you know, we didn't hit the ball as far back then as yeah. they do now. So right. I was going to hit a little, the wind was behind me, just a hair off the right. It wasn't a lot of wind, maybe 5 miles an hour, not even a full club. So I was just going to cut a little 6-iron into the flag because it was a back right pin. So for me, I was just going to start it left of the hole or start it left or just at the hole and try to hold it against the wind. I wasn't trying to, you know, turn it back against the wind. I was just trying to hold it. And, you know, Larry was up in that right rough and he was tied with Greg at the time. Yeah. I was standing there, I had the club in my hand and I was just got nervous and more nervous and more nervous waiting for him to hit his shot. You know, cause he took a long time. He was a fairly slow player anyway. But now being up in the rough, he's taking even longer trying to figure out how he can try to make par. So the longer he took, the more nervous I got. And when you're nervous, you don't want to take something off a club or you don't want to try to hit a shot. You just want to go ahead and swing hard. And that's what I did. I decided to go back for the 7-iron and try to let the wind help me since it was helping up from the right. So I decided to hit a draw, which, you know, at the time I was swinging well, so I could hit both ways. Not that I couldn't hit draws and can't hit draws. I mean, I just prefer hitting a fade. But yeah. at the time, obviously my game was on, so I was hitting all the shots. So I thought, well, it's a push for a 7-iron, but I'm a little pumped up. My adrenaline was going, and I just want to hit it hard. When I struck it, it was one of those things, and I say this every time anybody asks about it. When you hear baseball players say when they hit it, these big home runs and stuff, they don't feel the ball hit the bat. I didn't feel my club hit the ball at all. I swung through and it just took off exactly how I pictured it. And it just started right of the flag and started turning and the wind was bringing it. And I mean, it just looked like it was going to be a good shot. Whether, you know, it looked like it was going to be a good enough putt for me to try to tie. And that's all I was trying to do is get myself a birdie putt. And when it went in, it was just like crazy. It was the craziest feeling. And I couldn't believe that it actually went in. Just seeing it take off on my line exactly how I pictured it was amazing, and for it to end that way was over the top.
Well, and you had your brother Randy on the bag as well, so it was a family affair in a lot of ways. The two of you, it must have just been almost surreal after a while.
It was. I mean, he started caddying for me in Tucson at the beginning of the year, my first event. He was going to school at Arizona State, and he wasn't doing so well, so I said, Take some time off, come work for me. Let's, you know, because it was my first year, rookie year, and just didn't know anywhere to go and didn't know people. And so I was trying to get used to being out there. So having family there was fantastic. My brother, he played golf as a kid, but he didn't know golf. So, you know, as a caddy, he would just try to carry the bag. He had to learn how to rake bunkers, and he took some tips from a lot of the caddies and how to be out there. But I mean, I would do all the yardages and stuff myself. So it was kind of, you know, there was no team. I mean,
I got it.
Like they have now, but it was a lot of fun, and he helped make things a lot better for me out there getting started.
Hey, by the way, if the situation was 2026 and you're 21 years old and you have the equipment that you have today. So you hit a strong 7-iron back then. What would you hit today from that distance? Would it still be 7-iron or maybe an 8?
If I had the juiced up clubs I have, the balls, well, I do, but I just don't have the strength that they
right,
do.
Right.
But I mean, these guys are hitting 9-iron from that distance. And, you know, I'm watching some of these telecasts and some of these clubs are hitting from these yardages is unbelievable, you know, but I'm thinking they're hitting 9-irons, you know, from that distance. Not anybody, they're not back that far anymore. They're hitting 3-woods down there to, you know, in a 160 range, a 150 ranges with a 3-wood off the back tee. So it's just a different game than it was. But yeah, probably I'd probably hit an 8-iron, but you know, nowadays these guys are hitting 9-irons. They're swinging at so hard.
How long did that feeling of euphoria for you last after that shot went in? Was it, I mean, obviously you picked the ball out of the hole, the crowd's going crazy. How long?
You know, I don't know. It's still, when I talk about it, I still feel it. It's just one of those moments. Kind of like I had a moment kind of like that in when I was on the Walker Cup team in 89 at Peachtree. I was playing my singles match and I made a long putt on the last hole to win the match. And it, you know, it's just stuff like that. Just when you think about it, it just gets in you and you start feeling those feelings again. So when talking about the shot, it just gets me pumped up and makes me feel good.
Now, interestingly enough, as a 21-year-old rookie, that was your second win that year. Two months earlier, you won the Northern Telecom out in Tucson. It was your very first tour event, correct?
It was my first event as a member, yes.
As a PGA Tour member, yes.
I was fortunate enough to get a couple exemptions earlier in the year, like the year before, right after I turned pro. I played the Texas Open and I played the Southern Open, which is no longer around in Georgia there. And then I played in the team championship with Jim Simons. Mm-hmm. So I got a few starts, but nothing really, you know, nothing like now. But that was my first event as a member. And I was, because I went through the Q school in 89. Got one of the last spots. I was 50. I think I finished 51st out of, and that year they took 57 guys or 56 guys got their cards. Yeah. So I wasn't even going to get in the field until the end. And I ended up getting in last minute. I think I got an exemption because I went to school in Tucson. But I was going to get in kind of thing. I forget how it all transpired, but I was in the field, played the Monday Pro-Am. Flew out to Doral Monday night. I had to fly to Miami to get I was getting the Nicklaus Award for College Player of the Year, and they were giving me exemption to the Doral Ryder Open. So it was a combo thing. So I caught the red eye out there from Tucson to Miami. Spent Tuesday in Miami to do the awards thing. Flew back to Tucson, played the Wednesday Pro-Am, and then end up winning the tournament.
That is crazy.
It was nuts. I had a 6-shot lead playing the last hole on Sunday.
Yeah, correct. And then, was that that sounds incredibly tiring, but maybe that was as much a surge of adrenaline as anything else, right?
It really was, because, you know, I had adrenaline getting started for the week and I was just so pumped up, but it just kind of took away some of that excitement where I didn't have all day Tuesday to sit there and grind on my game and so it probably helped me more than anything, because I was playing well at the time. I wasn't really worried about it. Came through Q school and I'd practiced really hard in the off season, so I was ready to go. I think it just took away some of that anxiety of getting started on Thursday, because I had that little detour cross country in between. So, and maybe I was a little jet lagged a little bit starting on in my pro-am on Wednesday, but come Thursday, that adrenaline just probably got me back to normal. You know, played some good rounds to get right there. Was in the final group, David Frost and Jay Hawes. And funny thing, I'm on the first tee and they announced me from the wrong state.
Where they announced you from?
Las Vegas, New Mexico, instead of Nevada. So it was a little chuckle. Yeah, it was a little chuckle there and kind of broke up some of the tension. And I went out and played it. We were playing Star Pass. And it was, we played a lot of college golf there. I actually caddied for Brian Clare in the Tucson Open the year before. at Start Pat. So I knew the golf course really well, and it just I was hitting it well, knew where to hit it, knew what to do, and it just seemed to everything turned out well. I was putting well, and, made a bunch of putts and ended up, like I said, I had a big lead play in the last hole and ended up hitting a poor tee shot on an 18, hit it in the bunker, topped it out, knocked it on the green, and three putted for a 4-shot win.
It's always nice to have a 6-shot lead going to the final hole, right?
Yes, it is.
They were so pleased to be joined by Robert Gomez, 3-time winner on the PGA Tour and a member of both the Las Vegas Golf Hall of Fame and the Southern Nevada Sports Hall of Fame here on Musings on Golf. Okay, so speaking of your home turf, and you had an incredible playing career as a junior golfer. Then you won, what, 4 straight Player of the Year awards in the Southern Nevada Golf Association. Take me back, would you please, to the start. How did you get involved in golf to begin with, Robert? And did the game come naturally to you? Were you good at it right away?
I picked up my first club at age 2. I was we used to live down the street from an Arnold Palmer driving range. And my dad played golf at the time. He wasn't a great golfer, but he liked the game. So he was babysitting me one day. It was a Saturday probably because he worked Monday to Friday. So it was a Saturday. My mom was working, so he was in charge of taking care of me. Took me to the range. The story goes, I picked up his club and started swinging and hitting these balls, like, not very far, obviously, because his club was long. So he ended up cutting down an old 3-iron and put electrical tape on it. And that was my first golf club. I mean, I have pictures. Actually, I have the golf club here on the wall. It's in a box, shadow box. So, and that's how I started. I started at age 2. I think I got my first junior set at age 4 or 5 and started taking lessons right away. And I've had some great instructors throughout the years. I had one in Pahrump, and then I had another. Jerry Belt was my first instructor at Las Vegas Golf Club, and he helped me and got me started, because really taught me the fundamentals of the game. I was a junior golfer at the local muni course and would be there. My parents would take me, drop me off in the morning and pick me up when the sun went down at night. So I'd be there all day because they worked. So when I really got into the game, my mom would take me out in the morning. She picked up the game so she could go out. We'd have one of the first tee times, go play 18. She'd go off to work, and then I'd sit there and then go play later on in the day. I'd hit as many golf balls. Jerry was so great with me and let me just hit balls, and as long as they stayed out of the way, and I'd just book a tee time and go play with the guys later on. And it just taught me a lot of how to be, with some of the adults. In the game, and it just gave me time to practice. I mean, I spent days and hours, and that's how I got started. At age 14, I started taking lessons from Dick Huff at the Tropicana, and he's the one that really honed my game into what it was starting. And I mean, I worked with him forever, it seemed like.
What did Mr. Huff do? What? How did he hone your game at that age? What specifically did he do to begin to make you the player you became?
Well, a lot of it was, just refining my golf swing, refining what I had to work with. I think because I wasn't a big person, I was a small guy at that time. Yeah. I'm only 5'7", 5'8", maybe. At that age, I was only 140, 50 pounds, so I wasn't. It wasn't like I was a big person. So just working with what I had to play. I played the Tropicana Country Club there, and that was a tight golf course, really tight. It was more target golf because they had big pine trees and really tiny greens. So you had to think about where you were hitting your shots. So he taught me a lot of that course management. And what's weird is a lot of our lessons were just sitting in his office, talking about golf and talking about different ways to handle different situations and talking about life. He had a lot of knowledge in the game of golf, and for years and years and years being in it. And so I learned a lot from him about playing the tour, and it just helped me that way.
Yeah. And I would imagine the course management part of it was really significant in terms of how to play a golf course. where to look to hit shots, where to look, what part of the green you want to try to hit shots, when to take, when par is an okay score. There's a lot on that mental side that's, when it becomes your profession, is so, it's in a lot of ways, it's the differentiator between you and so many other guys.
Yeah, and especially back then. I mean, nowadays it's bomb it,
yeah,
bomb
true,
it and gouge.
Right.
I mean, it's a different game now than it ever was, and I think the art of ball striking has been lost a little bit on the tour these days. But you know, the guys have great short games, and that's about what the tour has become. Just hit it as far as you can and gouge it out of the rough, get it around the green or on the greens, and the guys putt better than they ever used to, I think. You know, the technology's there, and where guys have learned how to chip and putt a lot better than we did back then. And back when I was first coming up, and we really, and even junior golf to college golf, I would go backwards and figure out how to play a golf course when I was first coming up. Like going in college golf, we'd have to make our own yardage books a lot of times. So during our practice round, we'd be walking it. I'd, you know, step some yardages, and I would look diagram. I'd make diagrams of the greens and figure out where the best place to putt from would be, or where the best place to miss would be. I mean, yeah, now that's what the caddies do on the tour, but as a college player, I mean, we didn't have, you know, we didn't have caddies, or our coaches weren't really out there teaching us that kind of stuff. I mean, at least ours wasn't, but I would do that on my own, and that's just stuff I learned from being around Dick and playing the Tropicana and playing some of the older golf courses there in Las Vegas that aren't around anymore, unfortunately. But
yeah, you played the course at the Desert Inn. I mean, you played some great old
I did
the old style Vegas courses, right?
Yeah, I did. I played some junior golf. We got to play all over the area. So Desert Inn, the Dunes, Tropicana, the Sahara, some of these courses are no longer in existence. And they were, you know, the Las Vegas Country Club, just tighter golf courses, you know, not so long, but had to think around them a little bit.
You mentioned about flying back to Miami during that, you know, very, very special week, winning the Player of the Year award. I mean, you won the Haskins Award as Player of the Year in 89, the Nicklaus Award. And you did it all while playing golf at the University of Arizona. Robert, why Arizona? Why did you decide to go there? And obviously, it was the right choice for you.
Well, so I took four recruiting trips. I went to the Texas El Paso. I went to Texas A&M. And I went to obviously Arizona, and Oklahoma State was the one, and they were the top in the country at the time. But I went to Oklahoma State when it was it was January, and it was a little cold, and they were out playing a qualifier at Oak Tree. I couldn't believe it. They were out there playing, and it was, I mean, I was bundled up, freezing cold. Scott Verplant came in, and I think he shot 68 that day. I couldn't believe the round he played. Coach Holder at the time told me, he said, I'd come in and he would redshirt me right away. And that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to play golf right away. And I knew it. I mean, UTEP was fun to, you know, El Paso, but it's El Paso, and, you know, College Station for A&M, you know, it was nice, but when I went, I didn't have the feel. And then being at Arizona, I was close to home. And it was in the desert. I love desert golf, and I knew I would play right away. So, and that was the biggest thing, is I wanted to play golf, and I wanted to play college golf. I wanted to play professional golf. So I didn't want to have to sit out a year to do it.
Hey, I hope you're enjoying this interview with Robert Gomez, and we're going to continue with it in just a moment. But before we do, let's hear what Robert has to say about his personal experience with William and Harry Golf Shoes.
William and Harry golf shoes, greatest shoe I've worn. I mean, I used to wear the FootJoy Classics, and I was wearing Skechers before I got my first pair of William and Harry. And I'll tell you what, I haven't had plantar fasciitis problems since I started wearing the shoe. I have a narrow foot, so trying to find a shoe that fits me perfectly has been tough. Even the Skechers didn't fit perfectly. I'd have to wear insoles and orthotics, and these just fit me fantastic, and I love the how solid they are. It's wonderful.
At William & Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William & Harry is partnering with charities to give back, donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William & Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deerskin, calfskin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William & Harry, style with a mission. You represented our country at the Walker Cup in 89, and unfortunately, as you mentioned, at Peachtree, while you played well, it was the first time that Great Britain and Ireland won the Walker Cup in the United States. You were just doing some research. I think you were 3-0-1 in your matches. Robert, what was that like to hear your anthem, to represent your country, to be part of a team at that level of competitive golf?
It was fantastic. I really relished in it. I enjoyed the experience. I enjoyed being on the team and being part of it. And to represent your country in anything is a wonderful feeling. And yes, I had 3.5 out of 4 points. I earned that week. So I played well, but you know, Great Britain and Ireland played great golf and just bettered us. So, it was a great experience for me and glad I got to experience it for sure.
Was there a story or a particular win out of those matches that stands out from that week?
I don't know. I mean, that, you know, in the singles match, the last that,
yeah, you were saying about the long putt you made,
I made that long putt, but there was another match I had, one of the other singles matches. My caddy couldn't keep up with me because I was such a, I like to play quick, and I played fast. So it was the first day's match, I think, because I won it, and like I think I beat him with 5 holes to play or something, but I was, my caddy couldn't keep up with me because I hit my shot and I'd be off and running.
Yeah.
But that was, I don't know. I mean, that last match that I played was so, played a solid round of golf and made this long putt on the last to, and I think I won the match or I either tied it. I can't remember which, but it was an exciting putt to get going. And unfortunately the rest of the matches didn't turn out as well as we would have hoped, and we didn't keep the cup. But it was a great time for me, and it was just a kickstart. After that, I think I played the USAM. I think was the next week, so it was one of those things to get me jump started to get going and for my professional career, and you know, and played the Q school there in Texas. Right. The finals, I was actually, my first stage Q school was in Monterey at Fort Ord, at the Bayonet course, the year of the earthquakes. So they're in San Francisco during the playoffs.
Oh my gosh.
So I was doing a little journal thing for the Golf Week magazine at the time. And I'm 21 years old and it could barely rent a car. I mean, they let me rent a car, but I'm driving back from the course and all of a sudden the radio goes dead and I didn't know what was going on. So I'm going from Seaside where Fort Ord is. And I'm fortunate enough, a friend of mine set me up to stay with a couple, a family up in Monterey, up on the peninsula. So as I'm driving back, everybody's outside their houses. And I'm like, what's going on? They said, it was an earthquake. Didn't you feel it? I said, no, I was in the car. I guess the guys at the golf course felt it, and the people at the house felt it. They were without power. So we, you know, I slept all night and kept rumblings and stuff. It was just a weird week. And that's the baseball playoffs were going on at the time there in San Francisco.
With the Giants and the A's. That's right.
Yeah. And they had some, you know, obviously there was some damage to some of the freeways. Luckily I wasn't where I was. We didn't have any issues and we kept playing the round, the event. So I got through there and And then I think I went to Kingwood, Texas. I can't remember my second stage, but and then the finals was at the Woodlands in
Is it
Houston.
true that the Q school is the most pressure packed because so much is on the line? If you get your card, you're set for the year. If you don't get your card, it's a jumbled, kind of a jumbled mess in a lot of ways.
Well, and yes, that's and nowadays it's even different because it's a totally different type of Q school. But back then, it for sure it was. I mean, if they had 50, it was 50 in ties, and if you didn't get your card, you had nowhere to play. So, I mean, without looking for mini tour, it's just, I mean, I don't even think the Nike tour was the next year was the first year, or that was the first year for it or something. I mean, it wasn't even a thing, really. So, yeah, it was. It's a tough deal, and but at least now, I mean, nowadays, obviously they have more stages. I think they added a pre qualifier for the qualifier, and now it's just Korn Ferry cards and things like that. I don't know the whole situation of it because I've been out of it for so long, but I did. I mean, even after I lost my card and stuff, I kept going back to Q school, and it's a tough week. And tough weeks, but each week, if you don't get past the first one, you can't get to the next one. And the finals is the biggest stage because it was six rounds and you know, two different golf courses, a lot of players, took a long time to play, so it's, you know, the golf was slow and gave you a lot of time to think about what would happen if you didn't make it. Not so much what would happen if you made it. It was a lot
They did
more
well.
what would happen if you didn't.
Hey, we're having a great discussion with Robert Gomez here on Musings on Golf. I mentioned at the start the ebbs and flows of your career and the great start out of the gate that you had. Unfortunately, 1998, and I grew up in the D.C. area in Bethesda, Maryland, not far from where the Kemper Open was played. You were involved in an automobile accident at the Kemper Open in 98, and it really set you back. What the heck happened that day?
Well, it was a. I think it was Tuesday night, and Omar Uresti and his. He was staying with. They would have a cookout, a fajita cookout, and they started doing it at different events. Like his family would come in, his father and mother would come in, and they would cook fajitas for all the players. So they had that night. It was, I think it was playoff hockey time. So we went to the house. They were doing it. I didn't have a cable. So a bunch of us went to a local restaurant to watch the game. I guess while we were in there, it had rained pretty good that night. And as we were driving back, we all had different cars. A bunch of us had, I had my own car. Thank God nobody else was in the car with me, but I was just jamming out to Sister Hazel and going up that river. Is River Road that
River
goes right
Road.
by Convention up. And you know how it is. I was just jamming and just driving faster than I should have been. I think I was going 40 and I think it's a 25, but jamming out to Sister Hazel. I look up to one of the street signs that says stop on, you know, the stop sign. And you know, obviously the stop's coming ahead. I look up to see the stop and the road turned and I was going too fast and I went to turn and I slid and couldn't control it, and my car flipped up against a tree, right behind the driver's side, and I was in a Chrysler 300 or a sportier car. Luckily, it had four doors, but it hit right behind the driver's side, driver's seat, that bar that, between the two, the front and the back. So it hit up on that. Thank God, knocked me out for a little bit. Next thing I know, I'm waking up and they're already ambulance there you know, sent to the hospital. I had a bruised liver, bruised spleen. I hurt my right hand and my neck. And I was in the hospital for a week or for 5 days. I kept thinking I was going to be able to play in the US Open qualifier on Monday after the tournament. That's how crazy I was. But I mean, I didn't feel like it was that bad, but I was basically it set me back for a couple of years. I should have taken the medical, waited till I was fully ready. But because of it, I lost my card and you know, didn't have an opportunity to, so I had to go to Q school. But it was a couple of years before I could feel comfortable enough to go ahead and make the swings I knew I needed to make. And it was mostly because of my right hand. You know, growing up in Vegas and being in Vegas, you have to hit down, you know, the ground's pretty hard. So I learned how to hit down through shots. That's you know, how I learned to play. Hit down through it to get the ball in the air. And I was afraid to hit down through shots because of my hand. I was so afraid every time I'd swing through it, it hurt. And it just took me that long. And it did hurt for a while, but after it started hurting, it was still another 6-8 months before I felt comfortable to go ahead and actually swing down through it, knowing it's not going to hurt.
And then you really kind of had a career resurgence. I mean, you ended up winning Valero Texas Open in 05. You had a nice run of 3 or 4 years of making a lot of cuts and really playing well. I'm wondering, though, there had to be, I guess, relatively speaking, some dark days of you know, from the mental side of being hurt and maybe losing that confidence, like you're saying about with your right hand. How'd you deal with that of being away from the game and not playing the game that you knew and you knew you played well for so long?
You know, that was the toughest part. And you know, I've always said golf is 95% mental, and it really is. I mean, you know, at our level, you know, everybody hits it about the same. Some guys chip and putt it better, some guys drive it further, so, you know, that kind of thing. But everybody hits it about the same. It's just what happens in between the ears. And Tiger Woods is probably one of the best ones I've ever seen at it. You know, Nicklaus was a strong mental player, and he had it over and above everybody else when things went bad. You know, he just knew how to play. Same thing. Tiger's the same way. He doesn't always hit the ball well, but could get it around the golf course when he did. You know, when he struggled. Through my whole career, I've always been a streaky putter. So, I always say that the putter is the one thing that held me back from winning more often. I was, you know, if I could have putted better, more consistent, more often, I probably would have won a lot more, because I've always prided myself on ball striking, driving the ball in the fairway, hitting a lot of greens, and I had to do that with the golf courses I learned on. You know, Tropicana Country Club, you had to drive the ball in the fairway, or otherwise you couldn't, with the big pine trees, you couldn't hit at the greens, and the greens were so tiny, you had to learn how to hit, you know, solid shots and get the ball into a certain position.
Sure.
So I've always felt like the strength of my game was driving the ball on the fairway. Not long. I mean, I've never been a real long player. There was a couple of years I actually hit it longer with some of the equipment I had at the time. But overall, I've just been kind of middle of the road before, you know, some of the other stuff I've had happen. But my iron play was always the thing that I was always distance control, getting the ball a whole high, or close to it, or keeping the ball below a hole if I knew I needed to putt it up the hill, or, you know, that kind of thing. But being able to hit greens, and I always hit the ball fairly close. I mean, I seem to have more putts inside 20 feet for birdie throughout a round, and I would hit 14, 15 greens a round, you know, like it was nothing, and have, you know, 10 to 12 putts inside 20 feet for birdie. Just didn't putt well. I would three putt a lot and miss a lot of putts. So because I missed a lot of putts, I missed a lot of cuts.
So is that your biggest regret, if you will, as a player, that could you have worked with somebody more on putting and just become a better putter?
I've worked with many people and I worked with Bob Rotella on the mental side of putting, and I know what to do. I know, you know, and like I said, I worked with Don Pooley, you know, when I was in Tucson. I worked with him and worked with a bunch of different people over the years with my putting. And it just, I think it was just more of a mental thing than anything. You know, I'd miss a short putt and then the gears start turning and I couldn't get over it. And I would miss more short putts, because I, as a kid, I would, you know, you didn't think about it as a kid. You just putt and be aggressive. And when I started on the tour, I was an aggressive putter, but then, you start missing, now you start being less aggressive, and then you have to learn how to reread greens a little bit, and you just learn. I had to learn how to putt differently, and unfortunately, putting differently, trying to not three putt instead of make putts, and that's the wrong thing to do, but that's was got to my mentality was don't three putt, don't you know, and then. I get frustrated if I missed a but I hit it close and miss a bunch of putts, or you know, feel like I should be you know 4 or 5 under at the time, and I'm even par one over, and then just I was really weak mentally in that part of my game, so that was tough. But fast forward, it was tough not playing well and not being able to play and hit the shots that I knew I could hit. My putting was always the one thing that. You know, that held me back. When the belly putter came out, I started using a belly putter, and that kind of changed my career a little bit. It helped me because I was able to make that stroke that you're supposed to make. And so starting with that in 2001, I finished second at John Deere. It helped get my card back. And then it just snowballed and started, you know, repeating itself again, where I started playing well and started having a little more success again and being back where I felt like I should be. I wasn't winning, wasn't getting up there because still wasn't quite, my ball striking wasn't quite there because of my hand and, you know, just the feeling that I wasn't quite there physically yet. Fast forward, Texas Open 2005, I missed a bunch of cuts leading into it. I wasn't driving the ball very well, which was odd for me. So we were up at Nema Colin up there for that event, the 84 Lumber, and I missed the cut. And I went to the range on Saturday and just tried to figure out what was going on with my game. And something clicked. I don't know what, I can't tell you what it was, but something clicked over that weekend. Went to Texas that next week. Went to San Antonio and family. My dad grew up in San Antonio, so I had a lot of family there and a lot of support. Got there, started having a lot of fun, played the Monday Pro-Am. I ran into the press room, I think, for a second, and they were bringing the trophy in. And they go, somebody asked me if I wanted to hold it. I said, no, I'll just hold it on Sunday. I mean, it was just a weird thing. I go out and shoot 62 the first round. Something clicked. And I made some putts that week. And, you know, for me, if I made putts early in a round or like early on around on Thursday, I was going to have a good week. If I missed a few early, I was done. And that is probably the one thing I regret the most is that through my career, if I had some poor putting rounds early on a Thursday, I basically cashed it in. I didn't grind as hard as I should have. To grind out making cuts and doing better. Cause I mean, I learned that later on in my career where I should have hung in more back in my early part of my career. But I always thought that I'd have more time. You know what I mean? I never thought there'd be anything to keep me from playing golf and, you know, with the accident and then my heart surgery and some other, you know, different injuries I've had, I wish I'd have done better with that part of it early on in my career.
Well, let's talk about that. Quadruple bypass heart surgery in 2014. Robert Gomez, what led up to that? What happened?
Well, you know, I've had family history. My dad had triple bypass in his 40s. And, you know, I won two tournaments my rookie year, and I had a lot of fun. I didn't always, you know, I've never been a workout person. I've tried it in the past and just have never, it's never been something for me. I don't have the discipline to do it on my own. So I've never, and I would try it in the off season. I work with a trainer for a month, December, maybe November, part of November. Cause our season was January to November basically back then. So, and I played a lot of golf. I played 30 to 35 events a year. And, you know, all the other outings and traveling. So, I mean, I was on the road a lot. So the only time I really had was end of November, December. And I would start working with somebody, you know, a couple times a week. But then I'd get to the tour and and just I had no discipline to do it on my own. So I've never really been a workout person per se. So that said, used to like to have a few cocktails and used to
Sure.
like to eat bad food, ate a lot of fast food, being out there and just not taking care of myself. And it caught up to me finally. So I'd hurt my foot, and so I was out for about a month. I came back. It was my first round back, actually. I was in Orlando playing at Orange Tree, and we were playing our game. We shotgun, so I started on number nine. So I'm on the seventh green, so I'm almost finished. I'm on the seventh green, and I'm starting to sweat. I mean, it was June, so it was like the hottest day of the year at that point. But I'd started on some new medication, so it said it caused a little overheating and stuff like that. So I didn't think anything of it. Sweating profusely, really. Get done, I play seven and eight. Get done, sitting in the clubhouse. I was on the committee for this game we had, so I was in charge of scoring and stuff like that. So sitting in this round table inside the clubhouse, started cooling down. I was fine. About an hour later, waiting for the last groups to finish, I start sweating again. I'm thinking it's weird. I was living on the golf course at the time, so I jump in the cart. I told the guys I got to go. I was supposed to go out to dinner and a comedy show with some friends of mine, and got back to the house. And I driving back, I felt some pressure on my chest, and I was struggling breathing. I walk in, and my ex-wife was like, "What's going on?" Obviously, not ex at the time, but
Right.
now ex-wife. She was like, "What's going on?" And I couldn't answer because I couldn't catch my breath. So just jumped in the car. She took me to the emergency room, and it was a Friday afternoon. They did an EKG, so, and it was inconclusive, so they kept me in over the weekend. And did a heart cath on Monday and set me up for the surgery on Wednesday. Sent me downtown to, because I was at Dr. Phillips Hospital, and then sent me
Sure.
downtown for the surgery on Wednesday. And then it was scary. I was scared.
Heck yeah.
But
How long were you out after that?
I couldn't do anything for golf. I had the surgery in July. End of June, I guess it was in June. So I had the surgery, but I couldn't touch a club, really do anything until October. And I was out from golf really for a while, and I lost a lot of speed through the whole thing because I be having the chest open. I still can't feel my nerves in my chest, so I have trouble feeling my chest and trying to time up my upper body with my lower body, and my golf swing keeps me
Do you
from
have
swinging
that
a little faster
even to today?
even through the day. Yeah, I can swing faster, but I don't know where my upper body would be with my lower, with my lower to time it up to keep the ball straight. So I swing a little bit slower normally just to keep the ball in play. Because like I said, I've never been a really long hitter, and I could probably gain another 10 yards, maybe swinging, or 15 gaining, swinging harder, but is it going to do me any good being in the rough 10 yards further down or being in the fairway? I'd rather hit one more club from the fairway than chopping it out of the rough.
No question about it.
Because that's just me. Because I'm as a shorter person, I've got a flatter golf swing, and when you
Yeah.
get in the rough, you need a little bit steeper swing to get the ball out. That's why some of these tall players are so good out of the rough, is because you can get a little more height and steepness when they're in there to get the
What's
ball
the
out.
we're on our closing holes, if you will, with Robert Gomez here on Musings on Golf. You mentioned about the athleticism and the conditioning of players today. Is that maybe the biggest difference? I mean, technology is what it is, and guys are hitting it farther. Are they more athletic today? Is the technology, is there one factor, or is it maybe Robert Gomez a combination of better athletes, better equipment, and the ball, as you said, it's just a masher's game right now.
Yeah, I think obviously, I think the players are definitely in better condition. They do work out. I mean, they are better conditioned people than they ever used to be. But I think they've had to be because of the equipment. And I wish they would go back to a ball that spun more, to be honest with you. I mean, if you go back to a Bellotta ball or something that spins a lot more, go back to a driver that's less forgiving, like that. I mean, making these club heads so big and they've got so much forgiveness to them. I mean, I've always said that if you go back to a driver that's 300 cc's, that's less forgiving and go to a ball that spins more, you'll see the guys that have the better golf swings come, and they won't be able to swing as hard because their miss hits are going to be way more offline. Nowadays, the miss hits are pretty much straight right, straight left. They'll have some curve in them. But I mean, I remember, I'd hit these shots back with the Bellotta days. You'd hit these shots and you miss hit it a little bit and they'd be spraying offline. They'd be curving so much offline. They'd be out of bounds so fast. And that just doesn't happen these days. Because the ball doesn't curve offline as much. I mean, you have to do a lot to curve it.
Two final questions, and we talked at length before we started this interview about you playing on the PGA Tour Champions. And with a 78-player field out there, as opposed to a 144 or 120, whatever it may be on the regular tour, for you, that presents a lot of challenges just getting into PGA Tour Champions events, right?
It does. And, I was unfortunate that there was a rule change that kept me from playing when I first turned 50. But, I've had some opportunities, just again, my putting or something else has kept me from playing. And, for me, it's tough because I played the Chubb Classic this year. I was fortunate enough to get an exemption last minute. Had two great first round. I mean, played really well the first 2 days, solid golf. I was struggling with my golf swing, was working pretty hard with my coach for a week and a half before it, before the start of the first round, and was really solid. I was really happy the way I was striking it. Sunday comes up, hadn't played. I mean, I hadn't played a tournament in almost 2 years. So nerves and trying to do well, and I had two great days. I was really looking forward. If I have a really good final round, I can maybe jump up and maybe top 10 to get in the next week. That kind of thing.
Sure.
That's the stuff that went through my head. And it's the wrong thing to think about. But the wind came up. My swing still wasn't, I mean, it was great for the first couple of days, but I hit one bad shot and now my head starts turning with, okay, what that was that swing I'm trying to not do. And I struggled the last day and shot 80 and it was a tough final round. But for me, I'm having to do the sponsor exemptions. I write for the exemptions or do the qualifiers. And on the champions, I mean, with 78 guys, they only have five exemptions a week. So they've got three that go to players that have won events, and then two are unrestricted. It's going to go to anybody. So it's tough to get spots, and more guys are turning 50 every week and every month. And the more guys that turn, the further off down the list I go. It's weird. It's called the Champions Tour, but they go off career money a lot. And there are a lot of guys on that career money list who made, back in the day, made career money. Some of the guys turning are ahead of me in career money because they played better later on in their careers. Where I played really, really well early in my career. My career, my rookie year, I finished 26th on the main list. I made $420,000 or $460 or something like that. And you're like, wow, that's nothing. That's nothing nowadays.
Right.
So the career money thing is a little skewed on the champions, but it is what it is. And they keep giving more spots to that category, which you would think they give more spots to guys that have actually won events. But that's what it is. So it's a little tougher for me to get out. But I'm playing some of the best golf that I've played in a long time. After my heart surgery, I battled a left shoulder injury that plagued me up until last year, really. I mean, so that's 10, 11 years I've struggled with this shoulder. Didn't know exactly what it was. In 24, I had a frozen shoulder. I couldn't lift my arm past my shoulder that year. Right after the
Whoa.
Dick's Open qualifier, I came back and something happened. I had no idea. I was out for 2 months. Got a shot, rehab, I haven't had pain in that shoulder since the end of 24. So I played all last year. I mean, I didn't get anything, but I played all last year. And this year I'm able to actually practice again and work on my golf game. Cause I mean, with my shoulder injury, I realized that it was causing me some, you know, that one shot around where I hit it offline and make a double or a triple. And it was happening in qualifiers. And in qualifiers, you can't do that, you know, but I'd play a bunch of good holes, have one double or triple, and you got no chance. And I was doing that in tournaments. When I got in, I'd play a good round, and then all of a sudden make this swing, hit it out of bounds, that just, you know, all from my shoulder. So the greatest thing is now, without the pain, I can stay on the range where I've been able to put in an hour and a half, 2 hours on the range, where before it was like 20, 30 minutes is the most I could get. So it's hard to work on your golf game like that. Still been working on my short game, which is getting better. My putting is starting to get better. A couple of things, I keep changing it. And in fact, I was in Tucson and playing my practice round. I think I changed my setup 3 times and during the practice round, just trying to find something that could repeat. I've still struggled with the putter a little bit, but it is getting better. And I did make a few putts at the Chubb the first couple of days, but then the last day made nothing, you know, and still have a ways to go there, but I actually starting to feel better about it and starting to think better about my putting, where, you know, for a long time I wasn't. But my golf game is in better shape than it has been in a long time. I just have to get starts. And
You've got to get those reps. It's like Jenna Self and you and I were chatting beforehand. You've got to get those reps. All right, before we close here, we always close with a question about who would be in your dream foursome. But before that, I just want to ask you, how often do you think about, or do people ask about, the shot at to win at Nestle? Is that something that you hear, Robert, every day, occasionally? How often do you think about it?
I don't think about it a lot. I mean, I have the 7-iron right here room here, but I don't think about it often. I mean, I it is brought up to me a little bit when I go to events or go do charity outings or something. People that play with me, they'll bring it up, and it's still the highlight of my career. And when I do think about it, like I said, you do get those fuzzy feelings, those warm fuzzies. And I'll tell you what, it there's no other thing I would rather talk about, really. I mean, when people ask me, I'm happy to talk about it, and not, you know, just because it is something that people do remember. And you know, you watch the tournament every year, and
an iconic moment in the history of the PGA Tour. There's no question about it.
Yeah, and I joined Berkeley Hall Club here in Bluffton, and the guys were bringing it up during the event. When they watched it, the guys at the club that I've started to meet, I'm on a couple email lists for some of the games they have here, and they're like, oh, it was a great shot, da 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 da, and it's like it's nice to have these guys know and supporting me, and I've made a good group of golfing buddies here. So and there are people like that all over the place, and I have some good friends all over the country because of it, of getting to start talking about the shot or playing with them in a pro-am, and they start talking, and we just have hit it off. And I'm just very fortunate to have been a professional golfer this long and to have been on tour. Yes, it's a struggle right now for me on the Champions, not getting starts, but I wouldn't change for anything.
All right, Robert Gomez, final question, as I alluded to earlier, if you could have a dream foursome, three other individuals who you could play a kind of a magical round of golf with, and whether those individuals are deceased or whether they're still with us, who would those three be, and where would you go play that round of golf?
Well, obviously Mr. Palmer would be one. And you know, I played a lot of golf with Fuzzy back in the day. We would play practice rounds together. And my buddy John Daly, the three of us, the four of us going out to play, and yeah, would be a wonderful round of golf, wonderful day.
And what a hoot that would be. And where would you go?
My favorite golf course that I've ever played is St. Andrews in Scotland. That is definitely the top of my list of golf courses that I've ever played. So it would have to be that. I'd want a nice day. I don't really like cold weather, but
sometime maybe in June, July, right? But not.
Hey, I've been
August,
over there.
Maybe. I know you've been there, all right. That's true. It's hard to pick it.
So it is hard to pick it. It's just like Pebble Beach. I mean, Pebble Beach to me is one of the greatest spots to play a round of golf when the weather's nice. When it's not, you don't want to be anywhere near there. But it's just a beautiful place. But my favorite golf course would be St. Andrews, and that's where I'd want to play.
Robert, thanks so much for joining us. That was a lot of fun. We wish you the very best on the PGA Tour Champions next week on Musings on Golf. Sports Illustrated senior writer Bob Herrig joins us. Bob has a new book out. And are we ever going to have a fascinating conversation talking about the title of Tiger versus Jack, golf's great debate? That's Bob Herrig next week on Musings on Golf. On behalf of Janice Self, Kelly Elbin signing off, thanking you once again for joining us on Musings on Golf.